Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Rick. Who's that?
This is Pat.
Hi, Pat. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
Good, good. I had a good Monday. It's finally some beautiful weather. I'm up here in New York City, so finally some beautiful weather.
Oh, how nice. I'm in Tennessee. Yeah. It's a little rainy, but it's still nice. It's, warm out.
Yeah, I saw you guys are getting out some storms through there, yesterday or something?
Yes. Yep, started yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah,
hey, Rick, are you getting, I'm having a little trouble with motivation to kind of keep going. Are you having any trouble
with
writing?
No. You know what? I'm not, because I'm on a mission to get this out of my head. So, for me, it's actually been very therapeutic, too.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so I haven't had that yet. I mean, I don't do it every single day. Probably about every 2 days.
Welcome to the early birds. Let's have an open discussion. I'm interested in any feedback, thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful for us to talk about. How are you finding the seminars so far?
Hi, Dave.
I heard a woman first, and then the guy.
Yeah. It's Pat.
Pat, hi. How are you?
I'm good today. How are you doing?
Super.
Okay.
And then Rick. Rick is
okay, and then Rick. Yeah, go ahead, Kat.
Rick and I were talking about, I said I have trouble with motivation, kind of keep going with writing, but maybe I'm trying too hard, I don't know, but Rick's doing okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think for me, it just, once this thought starts, it's just really, I'm not too worried, I think is what David said in class is, not too worried about formulating everything perfectly. I just write what is in my head and get it out on paper, and then somehow it kind of ties in. I don't know. For me, anyway.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that feedback. Kat, may I coach you for a moment?
It's Pat. Yo, please.
Oh, Pat,
Dave,
I'm sorry,
I would love
I just
it.
Heard.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. First, you don't need to be motivated. You don't need to be motivated to do anything. That's a myth. How many times have you heard someone in a coach the coach or a coaching session begin with, I just need to get motivated to work out or to exercise or to lose weight?
Hundreds of times.
It won't happen as a precondition. That's like saying, I need to learn how to swim before I jump in the water. At one of my two best childhood friends, his mother told him she wouldn't let him in the water until he knew how to swim. Never to this day has learned how to swim. So here's all you need, a plan and stick to it.
Okay.
I work with pro athletes and actors. They go to the gym every day, 5 to 6 days a week. They're not motivated to do it. They have no desire to do it, but they know they need to do it in order to do what's next. So all you need is a plan and to stick to it. So that's what we talked about some in the first couple of seminars, is having a plan, creating a structure, and you stick to the plan no matter what.
I can do that. Thank you. I can
definitely
do that.
Think about when, are you a coach, Pat?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, think about what you do when you have a client who makes a commitment and then suddenly reports next time you meet that they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't follow through. So here's a couple of approaches to that. One is to look at the conversation that person had the instant before they said no. They got up to the point of they were committed to begin at 3 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. What did that person say to himself or herself internally the instant before that there was a no? Was it an internal bargaining, like, well, I'm going to really start next Tuesday? Or was it a defiance of their own authority to say, well, hell with it, I'm just going to go have fun? Or did they get scattered and not know exactly what the next step was? So here's the motivation that we all have as human beings. Two things. One, to avoid pain, and the other is to create pleasure, to generate pleasure. We're our minds and brains are wired for avoiding pain and generating pleasure. So here's from a coaching perspective, when someone has a plan and they don't do it, you might look at what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed, what's the greater pain if you don't proceed. So you look at natural consequences in coaching just like you do in parenting. The things that work the best in parenting are the same things that work in coaching. And you know, and those of you who are parents, you know or you remember, whatever you respond to is going to either sustain or enhance. So if it's great stuff, you're going to see more great stuff. If it's badass stuff, you're going to see more badass, because that's what generates a response. That's what creates effectiveness. So do what's effective for you with natural consequences, following, being consistent with how your mind and brain works. That's why I incorporate the mind and brain sciences into what we do, and we're going to be talking today about the science, the neuroscience of writing, and how important it is in coaching, because so many of the changes that we attempt are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. So why not all go in the same direction and do things that are consistent, and that's what make changes that last. When we do things in that way, and we do that final step of changing and transforming our identity, our working model of how and who we are, that's what makes change permanent. Because the most powerful force of the human psyche is to return to our usual behavior, to return to our identity. So if someone makes changes and doesn't incorporate that to revise the model of who they are, to revise to the bedrock of their identity, they'll go back to what they were doing before. When that change and transformation occurs internally, it's change that lasts. And then it becomes part of a new ideal that one lives up to, which generates self-esteem. Now, does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. Thank you. That's what I've been doing. I've been going back to the kept going back to the way I've done things before, and then I get discouraged or disgusted. So I
well,
see what I
need
to do
now.
Well, that's
the other basic principle of coaching that we have. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else.
Something else.
Right.
You know, we're paid at times to be really simple.
Yeah,
just listen very carefully.
It's so true. Thank you for that for me as well.
Yeah. Thank you for
great.
That.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. That's such a fundamental thing. That's great.
Wow.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Other thoughts, comments, or anybody want to log in on this discussion or ask or comment in any other way?
I this is Rick again. I don't want to take up too much time, but I just really loved writing chunks of things. I like how you broke it down into chunks, and it just really helps me.
Good, yeah. Because, you know, that's one way of shrinking the change. That's something we do in mentor coaching, is to look at shrinking the change. And, you know, a chunk is something that you can get your arms around, get done, and feel effective in doing. And it's a sense of beginning, middle, and end, and a completion. And
right.
this is one of the things that it might be helpful to think about, not just in writing, but in your coaching as well, to look at the components of a story. Every chunk is going to be a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. So the three components of every story are challenge, development, and resolution. The challenge is what engages. It's what activates that neurochemical pleasure response of wanting to know what happens next. From an empathic standpoint, it engages someone's experience to really resonate with where they are. It helps you to enter that circle. Then you develop it to move ahead and then come to a resolution, a completion, a closure, and that brings it full circle to create a memory for it. So whatever you're doing, if you're thinking about your coaching, think about the story that you're co-creating. What is your client's story? What's their wellness, their story, their money story, their relationship story? If you're looking at your writing, look at what's your story. And each chunk is a story in itself, and you cluster them according to what umbrella you want them to fit under, what theme or chapter or issue you want to develop. So I think it's a useful way to think about things. So as you begin to think in story, you'll begin to hear all kinds of stories and read about stories and think about various things from your clients to your writing as developing a story. You remember I mentioned every book that has done well as a nonfiction book, chapter one begins a story. A story engages and launches that collaborative venture together with the reader. So thanks for mentioning that too. Other thoughts, questions from anyone?
This is Kip.
Hey Kip, welcome. What's going on?
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to thank you for that difference with writing and editing. I found that extremely helpful and just freeing myself up as I go with not trying to make it sound and look like what I think somebody would like and try to edit in the middle of the writing. So that's very helpful.
Good, yeah. And whatever you do, when you engage any endeavor, think about the optimum state of mind. We're going to talk about this a little bit in just a moment. Think about the optimum state of mind for a peak performance and peak functioning during that state to match exactly what you're doing. And writing, creating, is a very different part of your brain. It's a different state of mind than editing. So think about what you can do to create, to enter that state, and to sustain it. You know, you remember I talked about that I write to find out what I have to say. Joan Didion said it in a very similar way. She said, "I write to find out what I think." I mean, when you think about it, we live to find out who we are. So this is a creative engagement, and that can make it really exciting and fun. It's the alchemy of words. So thanks for mentioning that, Kip. What else? Anybody got anything else?
Dave, it's Mike. I just want to maybe kind of weave all those two or three last questions or thoughts together. And you know, where I start is sort of what you had suggested, is that kind of stream of consciousness where, you know, you just take the pen and you sit there for 15 minutes and you don't stop. And then you step back and look at it and see what kind of what's there. And you can then you can sort of start to fine tune that a little bit and then get to that chunking piece you know, start to develop that from there, you know, and then you're actually writing. You know, get that down and not critique it too much. And as, you know, everybody, you know, we were just talking about, you know, stop criticizing it and editing it too much. And what I'm finding is that it goes from the stream of consciousness, which is just spewing everything, getting it all out, to chunking it down, to kind of actually letting it flow as writing and not even criticizing it until a later point or fine-tuning it / editing it, that doesn't even come into my mind anymore.
That's great. I think that's a really good application. So if we put together the comments we've heard from Kip to enter the state of mind to fit what you're going to do, from the discussion with Pat, schedule the time, structure it, and if it's Thursday at 3 o'clock and that's the time you've decided you're going to sit down, you're going to sit there. And, you know, you have a pen in case anything comes to mind, but sometimes you just do it. I'm going to mention Julia Cameron's suggestion about morning pages, and that really fits with what you're saying and Mike's idea of just, you know, chunking it and putting together what you do. So those comments really fit together.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, welcome. Who is this?
This is PJ in Houston, and I want to say hello.
Hey, PJ, how are you?
I'm really great.
Well, I wondered how long you were going to lurk until you finally spoke up.
Well,
what you got?
I have a quote I want to share with
you. Can you get a little closer to your microphone? It's a little hard to hear you.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, way better. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I'm at work, everybody, so I'm just going to stay muted in the background. And I'd like to ask y'all to stay muted, too, so we don't have a whole lot of background noise in the recording. And I'm sure Dave will do that. But I wanted to share a quote I saw the other day. It was Zig Ziglar. And Zig said, it relates to what Pat said, we have to be before we can do, and we have to do before we can have. So your comments about changing our mindset, which is what I'm seriously engaged in right now, really, really resonated with me.
Thank you very much, PJ, for sharing that. That's a great quote. When I made my transition from practicing psychiatry, psychoanalysis, I knew I needed to do something different than, you know, the reading of a scientific paper at a national meeting that I'd done. So Zig Ziglar's appearance in Houston was the first live event that I went to right after I made my transition, and it was totally eye-opening. So that was a privilege to see him. So that, I think that's really important. Thank you for bringing that in. Okay, I'm going to move us to the lecture mode, and I'll save some time at the end for questions and comments. We're going to talk about the neuroscience of writing. First, let's talk about your comfort zone. To write and publish your first book, you'll have to leave your comfort zone. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior, a gradual process initially, but then once established, resists change. So think of your comfort zone like a home thermostat. Any increase or decrease in room temperature, even a degree or two, signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute to maintenance of that comfort zone. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. A comfort zone is simply predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. And it can be simply a repeated role you play in a relationship or a repeated pattern, like procrastinating about making needed lifestyle changes. It can take various forms. For example, bargaining with yourself about seriously writing or really completing your book within a specific time frame. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's simply a rupture of continuity. You're breaking your own script. A routine is broken. And remember that a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. It's a collection of repetitions. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they wore headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image consistently 24 hours a day. So they had to be very careful in everything they did because everything was exactly reversed. So they had to move very slowly and think through every movement. Then they noticed about day 25, their brains had automatically made the adjustments. They had rewired. They didn't need to do this consciously anymore. They had developed new neuronal pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the same headgear were given at day 15, one day off, 24 hours out of the headgear. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point for their brains to make the adjustments. So this emphasizes consistency and continuity once you decide to do something differently. Your performance, your writing, even the money you make operates in a similar way. if people get more successful, they may feel vaguely uncomfortable or just different. If you make more money than fits with your self-image, it'll cue an internal thermostat to return to that comfort zone. Here's an example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners of $3 million or more file bankruptcy within the first 5 years after they win. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Reframe the discomfort as a signpost of moving ahead, validation of being in new territory. You've probably done this a number of times in your own way with clients in helping them integrate the change as more than something that they just do. So your mind can reframe, your brain can rewire. So one possibility here, make a habit of writing. Construct a schedule and be loyal to that schedule, Pat. So let's talk about frame here. How you frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change your mind can change your brain. Meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or a situation. So the structure of meaning is an inside job. For example, if a traumatized combat veteran hears a car backfire, the stimulus instantly creates an activation of that kindling in his amygdala that produces a startle response, which then transports him in a nanosecond to a different place and state of mind. To his companion, alongside with a different history, it's background noise that probably doesn't even interrupt his conversation. So each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. A simple example. Well, I've got too much going on right now to find time to write. Reframed. I have too much going on right now not to create specific scheduled times to write. It's a way I take care of myself. Your response, your perception of an experience and the meaning you attribute to it, that's all part of your story, is a bridge between an external event and an internal state. To discern meaning, you have to have a context to surround it. The frame can determine your state of mind. Think about how our reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into conscious awareness out of the millions of bits of information streaming into the brain. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Focus specifically on how your feet feel as you wiggle your toes, as you move your feet back and forth on the floor. Be aware of the sensation of the warmth from your feet. Wiggle your toes one more time. Now, your feet have been there all along, but you just cued your reticular activating system to attend to your feet and get feedback. In a similar way, you pay attention to whatever fits your life story, the framework you use. That's the way our brains work. It's much like a camera. Out of the whole millions of possibilities of things that we could focus on, our brain tends to follow what specifically we focus, much like a camera, to have a certain field of vision. An example. Part of your life story is your self-image. If somebody says something really nice about you that you don't believe, it won't register, or you'll disavow it with an internal comment like, what are they trying to sell me? Natural filters include beliefs, self-image, goals. So how do you reframe or reprogram your reticular activating system to let in what you want to achieve with your book? Well, Here's the key to this entire discussion on frame. When you knew I had to be up to something, rather than just talking about one of my favorite topics of mind-brain interaction. Your book outline is more than your blueprint and plan. It's your frame. When you start writing about something specific, examples of it begin to appear in your life. It's as if the universe is conspiring to help you achieve your goal. Yellow geeks keep appearing. You can't get away from them. I first had a series of experiences in psychoanalysis that I now have in mentor coaching. At that time, my patients who were therapists or analysts in training would notice that as soon as they really worked through an issue of their own and came to terms with it, suddenly there were a half dozen of their own patients that would bring up the same issue that they had just dealt with. Well, their patients had been unconsciously, patiently, taking a number, waiting until it was their turn. And those of you who are professional coaches no doubt have noticed and will notice the same thing with your clients. They'll wait for you to get your arms around something so that now you can help them with it. Now, as authors, you'll notice it again, and it will pertain to what you're writing. For example, in the first few months after the release of my book, The Secret Language of Money, along with at the same time beginning a licensed specialty certified training program for financial coaches and professionals, my clients began giving me illustrations. Their money stories were there at center stage, needing to be coached. That's what the law of attraction tells us. Whatever you focus on, you'll notice and bring about. So here's a very simple three-step combination to reframe and incorporate your new endeavor of writing. One, visualization. You can create powerful and stimulating internal images. Visualization reprograms the reticular activating system by programming awareness. It cues your radar. So repeated visualizations rewires your brain. Affirmations, the positive validation of doing and being what you want, are the story that frames and supports the visualization. To allow yourself to be creative, you have to lose the fear of being wrong. Affirmations will provide a sense of safety and hope, the story of what you're inhabiting. Two, change your behavior to precisely what you want. New behavior, new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, those pathways become just a bit more etched until, with enough repetition, they're deeply etched to be the default mode. As soon as they're well-grooved, you'll have a new habit, an automatic behavior, this default mode. Your future self lives in your present mind. If you clearly visualize that future self and create a story, the affirmations to support it, you can move ahead to actualize the vision. Now, here's just a brief overview of the science of a vision, the neuroscience of the vision. Visualization brings about actual physical changes in the brain, the same as actually seeing what you're visualizing. Whether it comes in from the optic nerve or from the creation of your mind, your brain can't tell the difference. Your brain assimilates a mental picture, whether the stimulus is actual or imagined. Replays of the visualization, such as repeating the vision of successfully attaining the goal, first thing in the morning, last thing in the evening, programs neural networks and neuronal pathways to more strongly etch the experience. And scans of the brain have also established that thoughts bring about physical changes in your brain. And this is what we know. When you program your unconscious, you actually create a future memory to live into. And your brain can't tell who conjured it, your reality. The more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. Now, here's an important aspect. You don't make the brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. Remember, the final step of change is to program new identity, to revise the model of how and who you are for it to be part of your identity, for it to become automatic. An example of how that doesn't work. 95% of people who diet gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image. Envision the experience of your completed book. Not of getting there, but of being there, of announcing its successful release, the entire experience of the successful completion. This is a way to incorporate your objective as part of your identity rather than it belonging to somebody else or just being a good fantasy. We know, for example, by simply picturing a danger, you can trigger entire body responses of fight or flight. So this is just a systematic way to reprogram your brain. Now, while your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can. And your conscious mind has to incorporate an evolving story to assemble that imagery and your new self-concept as part of that new story. Otherwise, it doesn't register or it just gets extruded as noise. So the key elements are these three. Repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision need to be renewed and repeated regularly or they'll be eliminated. Two, consciously incorporate this new vision into your ongoing story. So it's metabolized to become part of your evolving and authentic self. And thirdly, be very specific about the experience of achieving the goal so that it's not abstract, so that it's not vague. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. So the vision then serves as a guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Here's an illustration of that. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was imprisoned, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Now, before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had two 99s. Everything else was into triple digits. So what he decided to do to preserve his sanity was to visualize golf. He selected in his mind his favorite course. He would dress, think about how he was going to play, in his mind drive to the course, warm up, smell the flowers, make each shot, walk up to it. So he basically spent 7 hours a day, 7 days a week for 7 years doing this visualization. After he was released from captivity, playing golf in his mind in that way, his first outing, he shot a 74. The power of a vision of mind over matters. Now, this is something we talked just a bit about in the discussion I want to return to look at states of mind. And there is a 30 to 35 minute webinar on the home page of my website on master states of mind. And I would recommend it because I like the author, but I would recommend it because I'm only going to highlight a couple of aspects here that apply to writing, but I think you'll find it useful in coaching in any kind of performance that you do, including endeavors like writing. So kind of the preface or the overview. We each enter and leave states of mind fluidly and invisibly. It's kind of like the precision passage of a baton between relay team members. Each of us has a set of different states of mind, relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention, a whole number of things. A state of mind is a psychophysiological state. It's an internally organized software program of expectations, attitudes, meanings, and feelings. And think about a state of mind as exactly like a software program. It has its own internally consistent ways of how do you enter, what do you do once you're there, how does it process things, what things activate it. So each state of mind is very much like a software program with its own behavior and set of experiences, even to determine what seems relevant and then how processing occurs. So each mind-body state determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So a key element for us is to be aware of different states of mind in order to know what state works best for what purpose. We touched on just one aspect of that, that a creative state to enter and sustain that and protect that time is important because it's a very different state of mind than editing. So the regulation of feelings and states of mind involves the understanding and mastery of access to each of your different states of mind. I want to give you some examples of how artists and authors enter a creative state to fit to specifically what they intend to do. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the state of mind she needed to write her macabre literature. Not a recommendation, just a fact. Dr. Samuel Johnson and poet W.H. Auden maintained a continuous state of stimulation by constantly consuming tea as they wrote. Willa Cather read the Bible to set the right tone prior to her writing. George Sand went immediately from making love to writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin wrote while soaking in a bathtub to focus on his thought process, to kind of get that floaty, warm, creative feeling. One of my favorite authors, Diane Ackerman, does the same. Coleridge used opium before each stint of writing. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could immediately come back and recreate this experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. So basically, the corresponding state of mind and the reader often matches with that of the author. And think about how the author guides the reader to that state of mind through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. Each of us has a continuum of states with some level of awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and leave certain states. We become more or less aware of the best to enter for a creative endeavor, the best for conceptual planning. In fact, the optimum state of attention and concentration for each task we undertake, from the alertness required from a business presentation to a state of relaxation that's conducive to sleep. So how to regulate states of mind is in that webinar, and I would recommend listening to it, just in an overview, the two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: physiology, how you use your body, and focus, what you focus on. So physiology can simply be by deep breathing, and focus is perhaps simply to have a focus phrase. So there will be some ideas in that webinar about how to engage in that way. Let me give you just an example of that and how it can affect performance. Some of you have heard me tell this story before. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, and that was lowest in their division of 217 teams. So during practice, Reed had his players do one thing before each practice shot at the free shot line. He would have them do a three-part mantra, a cue, a focus, and a physiology. The cue would be to dribble the ball twice. The focus would be a thought to align the energy field of their brain, and he suggested something like relaxed and smooth, but emphasized that each person developed their own focus phrase, and a relaxation of breathing in, relaxation, and breathing out any tension. So in a 4 to 5 second period, two dribbles, a focus phrase, and a deep breath. In 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation. So let's talk for just a moment about creativity. Inside each of us is a natural, innate energy, a drive to create. In fact, there is a neurochemical system that activates with a reward when we do that, that stimulates us to further create. During an aha moment, a moment of insight, three different parts of our brain lights up, and we're stimulated to move then into a state that is more synthetic and creative and integrative. And think about how when information is given, a fact is given, directives and order, no part of the brain lights up. So creativity is a natural part of life. So what we want to do is enter a state of flow. It's a state of heightened focus, productivity, and flow is one of the positive states studied in the last couple of decades especially that contributes greatly to effectiveness and performance. From another perspective, flow is a state of mind of being centered and focused and immersed in a particular endeavor. This state of mind allows full immersion in the process of concentration and performance that creates superior results. So in the state of mind of flow, people engage so fully in what they do that they may even lose track of time. The experience becomes its own reward. It's a way of countering distraction and becoming immersed in purpose. So here are some things that interfere with this creative process. In other words, obstacles to become aware of in order to avoid. Waiting until it's the right time. Waiting until you have something to say. Waiting until you have enough money to justify the time. Telling yourself it's too late. Being concerned about what family or friends might think. Thinking that an opportunity, or let's say it a different way, thinking that an appointment with yourself for creative time is an indulgence or a luxury. So, in the beginning, it's not about where you sit, what paper you use, what you write about. It's about beginning. In the beginning, your job is to write, is to begin. So, here's a recommendation. Consider integrating your writing into other professional activities. We've already discussed how you'll begin to hear vignettes and illustrations to capture. Another strategy, present what you're writing about. When I'm working on a book, I'll only accept speaking engagements that are in the flow of what I'm writing about so that when I'm working on a presentation, I also call it a chapter. So here's an exercise. And this comes from Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way. It's morning pages. One way to foster this creativity is to do what Julia recommends as morning pages. Morning pages are 3 pages of longhand writing done first thing in the morning, totally stream of consciousness. She emphasizes that there's no wrong way to do them. Just write. Even if you can't think of anything to write, write anyhow. Don't edit or judge, just write. The morning pages are a primary tool for initiating or rediscovering your creativity. Insight changes the brain. This is an application, a result of flow. What I mentioned about an aha moment, a moment of insight, changing the brain. Changing a state of mind. When you solve a problem, neural transmitters immediately respond with a rewarding release. This is your most powerful way to write effectively, to facilitate insight, to create a situation that gives you a novel approach. So schedule, protect, preserve this space for your creativity to live and to unfold. You establish the crucible for this creative force when you set aside time and provide an environment free of intrusions or distractions. No one is going to give it to you. If you take it away from yourself, examine that. So, let's look just briefly at management of state-specific issues. Chokes, slumps, and blocks. A choke is thinking too much about something. We choke when we begin to think about something because we move from the automatic flow of a deliberate practice or an immersion in doing something to think about it. Even that nanosecond of pause can disrupt that flow. Let me give you an example. A pro tennis player I worked with was just about to compete at Wimbledon, and we examined her experience of her serve was off, and she couldn't figure out what was happening. And what we saw when we looked at it frame by frame was that the instant that she tossed the ball into the air for her first serve, she flashed just for a nanosecond on her coach telling her to toss it higher. That's all it took to get her out of her flow. An Olympic gymnast disrupted her implicit memory and flow by focusing just for a second on her chief opponent the instant before she did her routine. So this was simply about refocusing and finding a way to stay immersed in a state of mind. Now, I give you this example to think about, to be aware of the importance of staying in the flow of writing without stepping outside, even for a moment, to become an observer or to become a critic of your work. Reverting to an explicit mode and thinking about it makes it deliberate and considered and can disrupt the flow of your creativity, called a choke. Now, a slump can be reverting back to that pause or that derailment a little bit over, a little bit in a repeated way, and thinking too much can be as equally derailing as thinking too little. So think about, in your writing, your state of mind, sustaining that state, and doing things to protect it from your space to no calls, no texts, no emails, to stay immersed. Now, a block is simply the difficulty or the challenge to enter the state of mind of creativity. It's not something that you need to engage, but simply to get to the state of mind of your creative space, and you will have dealt with the block. Centering, getting grounded and centered, brings mind and body together in full focus. There's a bit more of this on the Master States of Mind on the webinar on my homepage. No, so here's a summary of the neuroscience of writing. Since old patterns are hardwired, consistency of focus on new experiences is what it takes to change this wiring. Concentrate on new behaviors, possibilities rather than problems or obstacles in order to create new brain pathways. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize, the completed book, to lay new mental maps. Regulate states of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain plus right brain, intellectual and emotional. If you're diverted to an old feeling or behavior, redirect the ideas and energy flow to new ideas. That is, the new story of the process of creative immersion in writing, the discipline and work of rewriting, and ultimately, your complete book. Remember that the power is in the focus, and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. Focus aligns and directs energy and effort. Remember, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. It has to be put into an output channel to make even learning, but especially doing, complete. And finally, think about your new experience and evolving self. How your new experience will require you thinking of yourself, your identity, in a new way, no longer in the old story. So here's how that sounds. I'm an author. So I want to add, we have just a couple of minutes, and then I'll move to open mic for discussion. Here's some inverse wisdom for authors. These are the highlights of the introduction to Outsmart Your Brain and instruction manual. This is adapted for authors. I came home from college after my freshman year and announced to my mom that I was going to major in psychology. And we talked, and she was excited for me. Then she mentioned that she'd made an A in her college psychology course. Well, I had no idea. I said, I didn't know that. You must have really enjoyed it and studied a lot. She said, no, I just answered everything on the test the opposite of what I thought was right. Now, you had to know my mom, but she was totally, she was not deadpan. That was just truth right there. Well, here are a list of 9 things that are the inverse of conventional wisdom for authors, sort of in honor of my mom, who thought it was all opposite anyway. 1, burn your bridges. Make it impossible to go back to an old habit or way of being. If you decide to quit postponing the completion of your book, make it impossible in some way to go back to postponing it. Create an uncomfortable scenario if you should slip back. Focus on the present without the limiting habit. Reward yourself for proceeding and not going back. And even if you have what you call writer's block, you don't get to go to the mall during your writing time. 2, do the opposite of what you would normally do when you're afraid, worried, anxious, uncomfortable, or stuck. If you're uncomfortable with public speaking, avoidance is going to increase the fear, so do more of it. Embrace it. Join Toastmasters. You have to jump in the water, as I mentioned, because you can't learn to swim on paper. 3, obstacles reveal desires. Show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire. Instead of figuring out a way to sidestep, overcome, go around an obstacle, consider it's not there until you create it. And here's the coaching perspective. When you're ready to recognize that you create an obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. 4, discomfort can be a sign of progress. Moving beyond your comfort zone is necessary for progress. It's brain definition. Comfortable is not a place you begin, it's a place you arrive. Moving from a comfort zone is necessary in order to proceed. It can't happen any other way. 5, lean into the unknown. If you wonder whether you can write and sell a book because you've never done it before, lean into the action of doing it. If you think you're too old to do something, you'll be right. You can tiptoe through life very carefully and arrive safely at death. 6, don't believe every thought you have. Well, I'll never be able to write a book. Thoughts lie a lot. They're like my Uncle Ted, you know, God rest his soul, or I'd have to use another example. You don't have to believe every thought that crosses your mind. You're not even stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. Remember Vincent van Gogh's sage advice. If you hear a voice say, I'm not a painter, then by all means paint. Then that voice will be silenced. 7, you do not attract what you want. You create what you focus on. cue your radar for early recognition. Keep an eye out for yellow jeeps, stories, illustrations for your book, opportunities to talk about what you're writing about, a notion of what your next chunk is going to be, a caveat. Talk about your subject, not the book you're writing. Talking about writing your book can dissipate the energy of its writing. How many people do you know who have a book in them or have been working on their book for the last decade? 8. You only see what you believe. Let me say that again. Some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And we know this from neuroscience and from quantum physics and observing quarks. When you change the way you look at things, the change you look at change. In quantum mechanics as well as in the brain, the question you ask influences the outcome you see. A well-verified law is called the quantum Zeno effect, Z-E-N-O. The mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. Consistent focus then rewires the brain. Use this law to help you write your book. You'll begin to see more of what you need to write about. And finally, and this is so huge, I think, believe in someone, and he or she will show you why you do. Neuroscience has demonstrated that authentic belief in someone activates the other person's brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. I want to say that again. Neuroscience has demonstrated that authentic belief in someone activates that person's brain to create in them a state of mind that can transcend usual thinking and performance. That person can be you, the author. Okay, we're in discussion mode. If you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in thoughts, questions, anything that would be helpful to talk about.
Hey, Dave, it's TJ again. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, I love quotes, and I just want to share one more.
Okay, super. I'm a consummate collector, you know, so yeah, go ahead.
Okay, it's by Anonymous, the only difference between a rut and a grave, G-R-A-V-E, are the dimensions. The only difference between a rut and a grave are the dimensions. And I think of my comfort zone as being a rut.
Okay, great. Thank you for sharing that, PJ. I appreciate it. Excellent. Yeah, I have a real respect for quotes and the things that can be said so succinctly and so cogently and carry such a powerful impact. So thanks for sharing that. Other thoughts and comments?
Dave, it's Pat.
Yes.
I just wanted to say what you spoke about tonight to me was immensely helpful. And I found the one thing especially, there was so much, but the problem is that was causing discouragement. I have traditionally given up on things too early before I got to what I wanted to accomplish, and that's what it is. So I can take 25 days and, you know, really work on write and do my writing and to be successful. So I know that was one big piece that I was missing. So thank you so much for that.
And one, thank you for sharing that. And one way to think about that is sometimes when somebody gives up early, it's that they haven't made the next step small enough. Because it's difficult to give up early if the next step is simple, specific, and tangible, so that there is a sense of effectiveness in that. Let me tell you a brief story, and some of you have heard this. Terry Fox ran the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. he ran as a challenge because he had an artificial leg, so he ran with a shuffle and a hop. But he managed to average 24 miles a day, did the race in 143 days. Now, I know I'm telling you this story again for the purpose. And he was interviewed right after the race, asked how he did it when he was so challenged. And he said, I just ran to the next telephone pole. So, again, that story is special for me because it emphasizes how all you have to do, all we ever have to do and think of in life is the next right thing. Then we do the next right thing, so what's the next right thing? Now, you have to have in mind where that line of telephone poles is going to have your goal, but all you have to focus on then, when you have the framework and the context of that, is what's the next step? And when you do that, there is an internal reward, a sense of effectiveness in doing that. So it's a stepwise process of goals that are small, specific, attainable, and have a larger purpose. So that's a great reminder, and thank you.
Thank you.
We've got maybe one. Oh, I want to mention, I will get this out as a reminder to everyone. I am going to have to be out of my office this time next week. So we're going to skip our final time or postpone our final time on the business of writing to the following Monday, May 7th. I'll get a reminder out to everyone in an email of that. And my apologies for that, but this is something that, you know, I did not have planned at the beginning of our time. So I'll send an email around. So we'll have our final seminar 2 Mondays from now. Any other final comment or question in the last minute?
Yeah, just one real quick one. Dave, this is Rick. Just on what you just said, I won't be available on May 7th, so will that be online, the wrap-up, like we can listen to it online when
all of the seminars are recorded and are posted by the CTA IT guy within
right.
the next 24 hours, so all four will be at that site where you downloaded the outline and the
right.
workbook and have
great.
Four ports. So that will be recorded for everyone to do an online playback. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. The last 3 weeks have been wonderful for me, so thank you.
Thank you all for your responses, your energy, and the emails and responses you've had to mine. So thanks. Look forward to picking up in 2 weeks. Thanks very, very much. Bye.
Thank
bye,
you.
Guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.